You're tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
We've got to keep fossil fuel on the ground, and divestment's one of the key ways to be doing that. That's why kids from all over the world are on top of this.
And the divestment movement is about something quite simple. If it's wrong to cause climate change, it's wrong to profit from causing climate change. And the divestment movement has taken off all over the world with this as its rallying cry.
My constituents, I have 6-7 major freeways, actually, that crisscross my district that, like a serpent, chokes the lungs. It chokes the oxygen, the air, and the neutrality.
Today is a milestone in a campaign for divestment from the gas, oil, and coal companies that are fueling climate change. We'll talk with California State Senate President Kevin DeLeon and 350.org's Bill McKibben. They're here at COP21. We'll also look at how ExxonMobil has targeted Columbia University and its journalists to expose Exxon's massive climate cover-up. Then, extreme carbon inequality. The richest 10% of the world's population produce half of the Earth's climate-harming fossil fuel emissions. The poorest half, about 3.5 billion people, are responsible for only around 10% of the total greenhouse gas emissions. We'll speak with Oxfam's Tim Gore.
Well, Oxfam's new report out today, it's called Extreme Carbon Inequality. It finds that the richest 10% of people on this planet are responsible for half of all greenhouse gas emissions, while the poorest half of the global population is responsible for just 10% of emissions. That's totally obscene, and this Paris climate deal needs to address it.
And while world leaders come and go from COP21, one couldn't leave home. Deposed in a coup, Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed sits in a prison cell. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from the COP21, the UN Climate Summit, here in Paris, France, where police have extended a ban on public protests. The ban, established in the wake of the November 13th attacks, was scheduled to end Tuesday, but police extended the ban specifically for central Paris and for Le Bourget, where the COP is being held, until December 13th. 2 days after the end of the climate summit. Meanwhile, a protester arrested at Sunday's protest at Place de la République has been sentenced to 3 months in jail, the police say, for throwing a glass bottle which hit a police officer. A second protester has been fined more than $1,000 for refusing to have her fingerprints taken at Sunday's protest. In Washington, D.C., the House has voted to block federal rules to cut power plant emissions 1 day after President Obama delivered a speech at the climate summit pledging the United States would help lead the world in addressing climate change. The Environmental Protection Agency rules seek to cut carbon emissions from existing power plants and implement limits on emissions for new facilities. In India, one of the country's oldest newspapers was not printed for the first time in more than a century due to massive rains and floods in the southern city of Chennai. The daily newspaper, The Hindu, did not come out today because workers could not access the press. The publisher said it was the first time this has happened in the entire 137-year history of the paper. The Indian government has deployed the army to rescue thousands of people stranded in Chennai as heavy flooding continues. Pentagon officials have announced the U.S. is deploying more special operations troops to Iraq and Syria. Speaking to Congress Tuesday, Defense Secretary Ash Carter said the special forces are authorized to conduct raids, gather intelligence, free hostages, and capture members of ISIS. He also said the troops would conduct unilateral operations inside Syria. Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, acknowledged the U.S. is not technically at war in Iraq or Syria, even as the military ramps up combat operations. Ash Carter was responding to repeated questions from Virginia Republican Congress member Randy Forbes.
You heard the Secretary of Defense today say both in writing and verbally that we are at war. Who declared that war?
Chairman or Representative Forbes, I think what the secretary is saying, because we've discussed this, is we view the fight against ISIL as a threat to the United States, and we are mobilizing all of the military capabilities that are necessary.
Who would have actually made that declaration? Is that something you would make, the secretary would make?
If it was a technical declaration of war, it would be the Congress.
But has that declaration been made?
No, it has not.
So then how does the secretary say we're at war?
Well, what doesn't the secretary say?
I understand, but I only have 5 minutes.
Well, I'm just going to tell you.
I would ask the secretary if he wants to elaborate and do it in writing. He's taking my 5 minutes. General Dunford, can you tell me, as the chairman of Joint Chiefs, if you know?
We are technically not at war, Representative Ford.
So if we're
That's Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford. Meanwhile, the British Parliament is debating whether to join the U.S.-led bombing campaign against ISIS in Syria. British Prime Minister David Cameron is urging lawmakers to approve the airstrikes. The opposition Labour Party has split on the issue. Opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn has long been opposed to the bombing. On Tuesday, thousands rallied outside the British Parliament to voice opposition to the bombing campaign. Protester Hadi Nasrallah spoke out.
When they're going to bomb ISIS, many civilians will die. Like, tons of civilians will die. I'm speaking thousands, because the U.S. already killed a lot. The U.S. and the allies, they already killed a lot. So if the U.K. is just going to make it worse.
U.S. officials have admitted that a man who's been imprisoned for 13 years at Guantanamo Bay was captured in a case of mistaken identity. Pentagon officials conceded they wrongly believe 37-year-old Mustafa Al-Aziz Al-Shamiri had played a more significant role in Al-Qaeda because they confused him with others who had similar names. Despite this acknowledgement, he's still imprisoned, and it's not clear if and when he may be freed. This comes as the White House has rejected the Pentagon's draft plan for closing the Guantanamo military prison, saying it's too expensive. The Pentagon's plan called for more than $600 million to close the prison and construct a new U.S.-based facility to hold remaining prisoners at an annual operating cost of $300 million. The annual cost of operating the Guantanamo detention prison now is about $400 million. In Chicago, Police Chief Gary McCarthy has been fired as protests continue over the police killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, who was shot 16 times by white police officer Jason Van Dyke more than a year ago. Chicago authorities withheld the police dash cam video of the fatal shooting for more than a year and only released it last week under court order. The footage clearly contradicts the police claim that Laquan McDonald lunged at Officer Van Dyke with a small knife. Instead, the video shows the teenager posing no threat and walking away from the officers at a distance as Officer Van Dyke jumps out of his police car and fires 16 bullets into McDonald's body. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced Tuesday he had asked for and received Police Chief Gary McCarthy's resignation. Mayor Emanuel himself is facing increasing calls to resign over what many are describing as a cover-up. In April, during the mayor's re-election campaign, Chicago agreed to a preemptive $5 million settlement with Laquan McDonald's family after they obtained video footage of the killing. The terms of the settlement, which was offered before the family even brought a lawsuit, required the video remain confidential. The settlement itself was not made public until after Mayor Emanuel's re-election. Meanwhile, Officer Jason Van Dyke, who killed teenager Laquan McDonald, is free on bond. Puerto Rico has made a $355 million debt payment Tuesday, even as the governor of the U.S. territory warns Puerto Rico is facing impending default. There had been speculation Puerto Rico would default on at least some of the December 1st repayment. Puerto Rico's governor, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, has long warned the U.S. territory is in a, quote, debt spiral, and that the staggering $72 billion in debt is unpayable. The once-imprisoned U.S. activist Lori Berenson is returning home from Peru, where she was imprisoned for nearly 20 years. She was released on parole in 2010, but was barred from leaving Peru for good until her sentence expired Sunday. Lori Berenson was convicted in 1996 of helping the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement. She was tried by a hooded military judge, and prosecutors used secret evidence against her. Democracy Now! Was the first to interview Berenson and broadcast her voice to the public after she was sentenced, and has long covered her case. Here's an excerpt of our exclusive 1999 interview with Lori Berenson in the Sacubaya prison in the Andes Mountains.
Did they present any evidence at the trial?
No.
In the actual trial, no.
Absolutely.
Are you innocent of the charges?
Yes, of the charges. Yes, I'm innocent of all the charges we've made against them.
Which brings us to the U.S. and what the U.S. is doing here around your case. The U.S. government. What is the U.S. doing? Are they helping?
There has been some pressure at certain times, but not heavy pressure. Not heavy enough pressure, at least, because I'm still here.
Mm-hmm. What do you think if they...
I mean,
for pressure, you wouldn't be here.
I think in the sense of more than a congressman, it's also a military agent, and that kind of support and patting on the back of Fujimori every time that he does anything. I think he feels like he's fine.
Facebook co-founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Dr. Priscilla Chan, have announced they'll give away 99% of their Facebook shares, currently worth $45 billion, to charity during their lifetimes. The announcement came in an open letter to their newborn daughter, Max. Meanwhile, a new report shows the 20 richest people in the United States own more wealth than half the population of the U.S. combined. The report, published by Chuck Collins and Josh Hawksey of the Institute for Policy Studies, shows the 20 wealthiest Americans, which includes Zuckerberg, own about $732 billion. The report also shows that the 100 richest households in the U.S. have the same amount of wealth as all African Americans in the United States combined. In Montgomery, Alabama, city officials have unveiled a historic marker in honor of the 60th anniversary of Rosa Parks' arrest on a public bus December 1, 1955, which kicked off the historic bus boycotts protesting segregation. At Tuesday's ceremony, acclaimed actress and professor Dr. Tommy Tenea Stewart spoke out.
Remember, it wasn't just riding the bus. It was the water fountain. It was the right to vote. It was equal education. It was equal job opportunity. It was judging you not by the color of your skin, but the content of your character. It was not about individual persons. It was about all people. Justice started right here in Montgomery, Alabama.
The new marker, dedicated to Rosa Parks, replaces a sign which was dedicated to her on one side and country music star Hank Williams on the other. And the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has released the shortlist for Best Documentary. Nominees include four documentaries featured on Democracy Now!, The Look of Silence, directed by Joshua Oppenheimer, 3.5 minutes, 10 Bullets, directed by Mark Silver, We Come as Friends, directed by Hubert Salper, and What Happened to Miss Simone, directed by Liz Garvis. Other nominees include Michael Moore's documentary, Where to Invade Next. To see our interviews with the directors, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting live from COP21, the United Nations Climate Summit, here in Paris, France. We begin looking at a new milestone in the growing campaign for divestment from the gas, oil, and coal companies that are fueling climate change. Mae Boovy, executive director of 350.org, made the announcement just before our broadcast today.
We're very pleased to be announcing the new commitments to divest from fossil fuels. And before I announce them to all of you, I just want to once again remind everyone what this movement for divestment is all about. We're here for a historic summit on climate change, and the divestment movement is about something quite simple. If it's wrong to cause climate change, it's wrong to profit from causing climate change. And the divestment movement has taken off all over the world with this as its rallying cry. So without further ado, today we're announcing that as of today, total divestment commitments have passed the $3.4 trillion mark. That's $3.4 trillion of assets under management, now fossil free. That includes a combination of different types of commitments, both commitments to full divestment, which we define as divestment from coal, oil, and gas, and also partial divestment, which includes one of those fuels or some other combination. Now, I also want to say that because there are varying degrees of level of disclosure with these commitments, we don't have the exact total of amount divested, but we do know that standard portfolios contain around 3.7% of fossil fuels. But the point here has never been exactly how much is pulled out in that way. That is why we measure the total amount of assets. That's for a simple reason. A growing number of investors representing a growing amount of capital do not want to be associated with this industry any longer. It is a rogue industry, and that is what these commitments represent. It demonstrates that investors are taking climate risk extremely seriously. So to close, I just want to highlight some of the commitments themselves. Over 500 institutions have committed to divest. That includes, just today, 19 cities here in France, including Bordeaux, Saint-Denis, and Dijon. The French Parliament has endorsed divestment. And between last September, when we announced the 2.7 trillion mark, and today, Uppsala became the largest city in Sweden to divest from fossil fuels. Munster became the first German city to divest. Melbourne, Australia's second largest city, committed. And the London School of Economics, another primary institution, we have someone to speak to that here, they've committed to divest. So we're really seeing a surge of commitments. It's very exciting. And to close, I just want to say thanks to all the people who helped make all these commitments possible. This movement works because it's powered by tens of thousands of individuals who are powering these commitments forward. So we thank you, all of you who fought for divestment and who will fight for reinvestment of where those resources go. Thank you.
That's Maeve Bouvet of 350.org. To talk more about these developments, we're joined right now by Kevin DeLeon, who is president pro tem of the California Senate. He led the effort in the California State Senate to pass a resolution to divest two of the world's largest pension funds, California's public employees and state teachers' retirement system. Together, the two funds represent nearly $500 billion in assets. Also with us, Phil McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, which has played an instrumental role in the divestment movement. We're going to begin with the president of the California State Senate. We just heard Maeve Bouvet lay out the cities around the world that are divesting. California, talk about the significance of the state and what's happening there.
Well, thank you so much, Amy. The significance, I think, is huge because California is the seventh largest economy in the entire world on planet Earth. And what we have done successfully to date is that we have delinked and decoupled carbon from GDP, which is very important. To underscore that, that means we have actually grown the economy. We've added more jobs in California, put people to work simultaneously. We have actually reduced our carbon emissions output in California. Specifically with Senate Bill 185, I think it is important that we align our values with our policies. Thermal coal is among the dirtiest fossil fuels in existence. They cause a lot of diseases, illnesses for young children, emphysema, cancer, asthma rates have skyrocketed because of dirty fossil fuels, specifically because of thermal coal. So what we did with Senate Bill 185 is we ensured that the pension plans in California combined CalPERS and CalSTRS, which are the largest in the nation, $500 billion in value, divest from thermal coal. So starting in 2017, all our investments in our pension plans in the state of California will be thermal coal free.
And how do you answer those who say it's illegal actually to do this because you're supposed to simply maximize profit, these pension funds?
I think that's a very fair question because, first and foremost, we have movements happening throughout the world, throughout the country, but specifically, these pension plans have a fiduciary responsibility to the pensioners, whether they're teachers, firefighters, police officers. We got to make sure we return value, maximum value. But the bottom line is this, and I want to underscore the following. With regards to thermal coal in America, the value from these publicly traded companies have fallen at least approximately by 95%. So that is a bad, risky bet for for pensioners in California and throughout the nation.
At the news conference just before our broadcast, you described the serpent. Explain.
Well, in my district, as a senator for the state of California, as a leader, but in my Senate District 24, 1 million constituents downtown Los Angeles, we'll have the freeways at the 2, the 5, the 10, the 60, the famous Hollywood 101 freeway, the 710, as well as the 110 freeway. These are seven major freeways that crisscross my district like a serpent that chokes the air, the oxygen, out of a young child's lungs. And that's why asthma rates are so high, skyrocketing. The number one reason for absenteeism in our public school system is due to asthma. These airborne illnesses that these children contract have to end up going to the emergency room. It costs schools hundreds of millions of dollars, costs parents lost days of work. It impacts our economy. That's why we must tackle this issue head on, and I think we're doing so in the state of California.
In your response to what happened in Washington, D.C., the House voting to block federal rules to cut power plant emissions only hours after President Obama delivered his climate speech here in Paris.
Well, I'm going to give lots of credit to our President, Barack Obama. Unfortunately, he's had to move forward with our public policies through the executive level, through executive decision-making, because he has no partners at the legislative level in the Congress. I'm very concerned that Washington, D.C., specifically the Congress, has yet to recognize climate change as a reality. That's why, as a subnational, that's why the seventh largest GDP on planet Earth, the state of California, is not going to hold its breath for the congressional members to take action. We're going to take action on our own.
I mean, repeat that, because we're in a global space right now here in Le Bourget, which is right north of Paris, at the COP21. How California, not the entire country of the United States, how large its economy is in the world.
We are the seventh largest GDP on planet Earth. To put this in context, number one GDP, obviously, is the United States as a whole in the aggregate. Two, China. Three, Japan. Four, Germany. Five, France. Number six, it's the UK. And number seven, it's the great state of California. Now, our economy is larger than every other nation, minus six nations on planet Earth. So to put this in context, we have added 500,000 new jobs in the clean energy space, energy efficiency, as well as renewables. What we're trying to accomplish in California is we're trying to recalibrate a new economy of tomorrow that's clean, that's cheap, that puts people to work. And that's what we're trying to calibrate, because we're not waiting for Washington, D.C., because unfortunately they have yet to deal with this in a very responsible manner.
Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. We just heard your colleague, May Booby. How significant is the divestment movement right now?
Amy, you were the first person almost to cover this movement. You remember 3 years ago when it was me writing in Rolling Stone, you know, with Justin Bieber on the cover. The same argument now, because of the divestment movement, the argument that these companies have more carbon in their reserves than we can burn, that's no longer Rolling Stone. That's now the conventional wisdom the world over. There are great leaders like Kevin De Leon. There are people like the governor of the Bank of England, like the people at Deutsche Bank, like the IMF, like the World Bank. Really, this whole COP now, understanding that we have to leave most fossil fuel on the ground, and that when we do, those fossil fuel companies are going to be worth a lot less.
What are you most surprised by in the United States, whether it's a foundation, whether it's a university?
So the great moment came a year ago when the Rockefeller family, heirs to the greatest fossil fuel fortune on Earth, began divesting. And after that, it was as if the dam broke. Clearly, the most important thing that's happened in the states in terms of divestment was what happened in California. We're talking $500 billion worth of pension funds. And thank God they got out when they did. They've lost $5 billion in California by not divesting 3 years ago. It's one of the reasons that it was possible for Senator De Leon to rally his colleagues to do the right thing now.
As we wrap up, State Senator Kevin De Leon, some might say, what are you doing in Paris? You should be back in California.
Well, I say this, is that Washington, D.C., other than our president, is taking action. The Congress, the Republican-dominated Congress, have not. This is not necessarily a partisan issue. It's not an ideological issue. This is a scientific issue. Therefore, it is a political issue, because there is a lack of political leadership in the Congress in Washington, D.C. Therefore, we're not going to wait for them to act. Again, California is the seventh largest economy in the world. What California does, first and foremost, the rest of the country, as well as the rest of the world, follows closely what happens in California. California. Therefore, we're moving forward with our public policies.
And as we wrap up, how has climate change affected California?
Well, I'll tell you one thing right now. You don't have to look farther than California to see how the devastating impacts. We're in our fifth year of a record drought in California, so we have the crisis of water. We have farm workers who are currently unemployed and in food lines in the Central Valley because there's no water. If there's no water, there's no jobs. It's that simple. We have devastating fires. We have spent, from our general fund, upwards up to $4 billion. That's with a B, $4 billion, fighting these forest fires. I'd rather spend $4 billion investing in children, in public education, investments in higher education, than combating forest fires due to climate change because of the drought in California.
Thanks so much. I want to thank you for being
thank
with
you.
Us. Kevin DeLeon, President Pro Tem of the California Senate. He led the effort in California State Senate to pass a resolution to divest two of the world's largest pension funds. And Bill McKibben, please stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Christian Parenti.
Well, we have to radically reduce carbon emissions starting immediately and in the next few decades. And that, sadly, means that these societies as they exist, more or less, these institutions, that have to at least take the first steps. And I think it's actually possible to force capitalism as it is to deal with mitigation.
On Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
Increasingly, police do not live in the neighborhoods or even the cities that they patrol. But is that a problem? Law enforcement agencies around the country are struggling for answers to a question that's about race, class, and geography. The Elusive Neighborhood Cop on Making Contact, Thursday, 12:30 p.m.
Climate Walkers here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodwin. We're broadcasting from COP21 from the UN Climate Summit. We'll be here for the full 2 weeks of the summit. Meanwhile, in India, one of the country's oldest newspapers was not printed for the first time in more than a century due to massive rains and floods in the southern city of Chennai. The daily newspaper, The Hindu, did not come out today because workers couldn't access the press. The publisher said it was the first time this has happened in the entire 137-year history of the paper. The Indian government has deployed the army to rescue thousands of people stranded in Chennai as heavy flooding continues. We're joined right now by the managing editor of the paper. We're joined by Anantha Krishnan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
So we were just talking yesterday in our office, and then we get this news. I know you just have a few minutes. Talk about the significance of what's happened to The Hindu, your newspaper, and where Chennai is in India.
The Hindu is one of the oldest newspapers in India. It was started in 1878, and it's published all over the country. There's a long tradition of supporting liberal journalism and credible news gathering. So it's the first time that this has happened due to circumstances entirely beyond our control. And we are in the southern east coast of the country, which is normally prone to hurricanes and cyclones, as we call them. And so this is the first time that we've been hit by 50 centimeters of rain in one day. And we found that the whole city, which is flat land basically, and which has gone completely under. It's the first time it's happened.
The reports are that at this point something like 188 people have died in recent weeks as a result of the floods.
We've had three spells of really bad rain in this season, and already we had information that 60 odd people had died in the past two instances, and I'm not surprised that more people have died. There's a lot of background to this in the sense that the real estate development, which is uncontrolled, and the whole change in the climate and the intensification of the kind of weather that we are witnessing in Chennai and even some of the cities along the coast in Tamil Nadu. It's a clear cause of worry.
Of course, the horror is how many people have died, but the irony of the newspaper not coming out as your team is here covering the climate summit about what to do about climate change.
Yes, actually, Chennai is the base of the newspaper, in fact, our nerve center, and it is where we have our largest circulation and our greatest voice. And this being the case, it's a real tragedy that the paper couldn't come out, you know, for the first time in this fashion. And the whole
what happened at the presses? Did you have a description report back from home?
Some of the people were able to come into work because some of the train lines that are running overhead, they're still continuing to operate with great difficulty. A few staff have managed to come to the office, and we have the edition going for tomorrow. So that's at least, you know, on the cards. But we don't know how we will distribute the paper tomorrow. It's going to be very difficult. And the presses are away from the actual printing center. They're the main center. So the printing center is away about 45 kilometers to the south, which is again along the coast. And it's very difficult to, you know, for people to reach when large swathes of the city and the surrounding areas are inundated. It's a deluge.
I want to thank you, Anantha Krishnan, managing editor of The Hindu, one of the largest daily newspapers in India. Again, The Hindu now printed for the first time in more than a century due to massive rains and flooding, which made the press inaccessible. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn right now to the oil giant ExxonMobil, it's under criminal investigation in New York over claims it lied to the public and investors about the risks of climate change. Now Exxon is fighting back against the journalists who expose how Exxon concealed its own findings dating back to the 1970s that fossil fuels cause global warming, alter the climate, and melt the Arctic ice. Students at Columbia Journalism School collaborated with the Los Angeles Times on two of the exposés. Exxon accused the students of producing inaccurate and misleading articles. In its complaint, Exxon also referred to the, quote, numerous and productive relationships ExxonMobil has with Columbia. Exxon's donated nearly $220,000 to the school. On Tuesday, Steve Cole, the dean of the Columbia Journalism School, responded to Exxon's critique written to Columbia's president. After an extensive review, Cole wrote, quote, your letter disputes the substance of the two articles in the number of respects, but consists largely of attacks on the project's journalists. I've concluded your allegations are unsupported by evidence. More than that, I've been troubled to discover you've made serious allegations of professional misconduct in your letter against members of the project, even though you or your media relations colleagues possess email records showing your allegations are false, Cole wrote. Well, our guest, Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, has been following the Exxon exposés closely. In October, he was arrested after staging a one-man protest at his local Exxon station in Vermont. He held a sign reading, this pump temporarily closed because ExxonMobil lied about climate. Bill McKibben, you're a journalist yourself. Talk about the significance of ExxonMobil writing this letter of complaint to the president of Columbia University, Lee Bollinger, who then turned the letter over to Steve Cole, also a leading journalist, who did an investigation of Columbia Journalism School students.
So Exxon is never very subtle, and this was a particularly heavy-handed instance of it. Their letter to Columbia can only be described as thuggish. It carried every kind of implication about how they would do one thing or another to them if they didn't get satisfaction. But I think they might think twice before they do it again. The letter that came back from Steve Cole at Columbia was a six-page masterpiece of dissection. It sort of shows what happens when real reporters go up against PR people. It was remarkable, Amy. These stories, I mean, this is just Exxon trying to kick up smoke around the edges. There's no problem with the stories. They're incredibly powerful, incredibly true, and so salient to where we sit today. If Exxon had told the truth about what it knew 25 years ago, we would not be needing to have COP 21. We would have, sometime around COP 3 or 4, really gotten down to work as a planet, and this problem wouldn't be solved yet, but we wouldn't have wasted 25 years and phony debate.
And we did an extensive look at this on Democracy Now, on the investigation of both Inside Climate News, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalistic organization, and Los Angeles Times, which, of course, has also won many Pulitzers. But the evidence that they had top scientists, they were deeply concerned about this, doing very good work and saw climate change as real.
Absolutely.
But then what happened?
Well, then they, instead of acting on their knowledge, they instead set up the architecture of denial and disinformation. There was a remarkable piece that came out, a study that came out in Nature yesterday, documenting the fact that the money from Exxon and the Koch brothers constituted the sort of epicenter of denial. This was one of these big data analyses that traced the links between thousands of different organizations and newsletters and front groups, and they traced it back to Exxon. That's why the Secretary of State yesterday, John Kerry, in a pretty rare moment in Rolling Stone, really let loose on Exxon and said that it was, if it's, these allegations were true, it was worse than the tobacco industry and a betrayal of everything that it meant to be a responsible corporation.
And the significance of the New York State Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, launching a criminal probe into ExxonMobil.
Well, you can be sure that Exxon's taking it seriously, because yesterday they hired one of the most expensive lawyers in the country, Theodore Wells, most recently famous for having written the Deflategate report about the New England Patriots and last year's football season. Theodore Wells from Paul Weiss Rifkin in New York is now Exxon's on retainer for Exxon to try and battle these allegations. But good luck to him, because the evidence down there in black and white is pretty stunning. Remember, at the best, no one is saying, I mean, the best that anyone's saying is that Exxon was merely morally reprehensible, not outright criminal. That's the best defense that anybody's mounted for them so far.
So we're not talking about a civil probe. We're talking about a criminal probe. This could land Exxon officials in jail?
Well, who knows? I mean, they haven't said they've, at the moment. They're just subpoenaing documents. We're still at the beginning stages of this. And, of course, the great hope is that other attorney generals, Kamala Harris in California, for instance, will, we hope, join in at some point, and at the Department of Justice. 360,000 Americans have petitioned the Department of Justice asking them to investigate Exxon.
And on the issue of ExxonMobil writing the letter to the president of Columbia University, in it mentioning the amount of money they've given to Columbia, do you see this as an attack on freedom of the press?
Oh, I mean, who knows what precisely they had in mind, but Exxon has attacked the freedom of thought of an entire planet for 25 years. They knew the truth and they hid it. They told people things that they knew not to be true. There's no more devastating attack on the freedom of thought than that.
One more question I want to raise with Bill McKibben, our guest right now, and that's the Guardian piece that he wrote called "The Paris Summit is Missing One of the Great World Leaders on Climate." The article is about former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed. For years, he was a leading climate campaigner. Today, he sits in a prison cell after being deposed in a coup. This is a clip of Mohamed Nasheed in 2009.
Four countries to defend Poland in the 1930s because it was a frontline state. It's very important to take care of the Maldives now, because the Maldives and many other small states are in the front line of what is happening to the world, to climate today. If you can't defend the Maldives today, you won't be able to defend yourself tomorrow.
That was Mohamed Nasheed in 2009, and I certainly remember, met Mohamed Nasheed for the first time that year at the Copenhagen Climate Summit, one of the most vocal voices around the effects of climate change with his island nation, Maldives. Bill McKibben, where is he today?
Well, he's in prison, on a prison island in that archipelago. Look, The Copenhagen Climate Summit, a great failure, had very few heroes, but one of them was Mohamed Nasheed. I won't soon forget him leading a huge crowd of people and chanting 3-5-0, booming out across that conference center. Nor will I forget ever the activism that he displayed. He, you know, taught his whole cabinet to scuba dive so they could hold an underwater meeting on their dying coral reef, something that was on the front page of every paper around the planet to dramatize what was happening. What happened to him is horrible. He was not only a climate leader, of course, he was a great freedom fighter. They call him the Mandela of the Indian Ocean. He overthrew a dictator of 30 years in a free election, but the dictator's people fought back and in a military coup deposed him. Not only is he now in jail, but so are many, many others, including many leaders of other political parties. The Maldives has turned into a full-on autocracy. Nasheed is apparently in poor health and being denied medical treatment. Amnesty International is speaking out on his behalf. So is Amal Clooney, who's traveled there, the human rights lawyer, to visit with him. But it is a disgrace, and one hopes that leaders here at this conference will remember his leadership and speak up a little bit on his behalf.
Sadly, after the gun was put to his head and he was deposed in a military coup, the U.S., I believe, was the first, if not one of the first countries, to recognize the new coup government.
It's really, really sad. It's not as if the Maldives has some kind of enormous strategic value to anyone. It has enormous moral value. This is an archipelago of 1,000 islands stretching across the equator in the Indian Ocean, but the highest point in the archipelago is only a few meters above sea level. They are the poster child for where not to be in a warming world. And it was Nasheed promised to take his whole country carbon neutral by 2020. Instead, the dictators running it now are inviting the oil industry in to drill around the edges of those islands. If you want to think about irony, it doesn't get much better than that.
Folks should check out our interview with Mohamed Nasheed before he was imprisoned at democracynow.org. But finally, we're here at the UN COP21, Bill McKibben. The state of the talks are voluntary standards for each country, targets enough. What do you want to see come out of this? Do you feel it's a failure from the start or actually has the possibility of some kind of success?
So I've never sort of thought of it in either of those terms. It always seems to me like this event is not the game, it's the scoreboard. What it reflects is what's happened over the last 5 years when we've built a movement all over the world. Before Copenhagen, there was no climate movement, so there was no pressure on anyone there. Barack Obama could come home from Copenhagen with a no agreement, Hillary Clinton, no agreement, and pay no price. But that's no longer true for them or almost anybody else. So we'll get something out of here, but it won't be enough.
What will it be?
We'll probably be on a path to a world that heats up about 3.5 degrees Celsius instead of 5 degrees.
And that's in Fahrenheit?
6 or 7 degrees instead of 9 or 10. So an uninhabitable world, okay? But what it tells us is what the score is now and how much work more we have to do. My guess is we're going to come out of here saying, look, the governments of the world have done what they're going to do for the moment, not enough. We've got to talk now to the people behind the governments. We've got to go after the fossil fuel industry, which still holds the balance of power. That's why this Exxon investigation is of the absolute first importance.
Are you concerned about the ban on protests? It was planned through Tuesday, which is just after the massive mobilization was planned for this past Sunday. Instead, there was a human chain. Now they have extended it just for downtown Paris and right around here through to December 13th. Direct actions were planned for December 12th. What's the significance of that?
I'm concerned about it, but what I'm gratified about is the way that the rest of the world has picked up. So last weekend, we helped organize with the VAS and others demonstrations, 2,200 places around the globe. Just sitting and watching the pictures flow in made me cry. I mean, it was unbelievable to see people from every corner of the planet, from Cameroon, from Minneapolis, from Malawi, from Australia, from Stockholm, every place else around the world we can still protest, so it's a good thing that there are people in those places who are stepping up.
Bill McKibben is co-founder of 350.org, author of a number of books, including Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. We'll be back in a minute.
Two chances to hear Buffy St. Marie this week. First on Sprouts, Thursday at noon, then on Art of the Song, Sunday morning at 7.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we explore the conditions for child care workers and for Kansas teachers. Tune in to Rockabye Baby, The Wages is Crazy. And then we ask, why are Kansas teachers fleeing? We'll talk to a recent Kansas Teacher of the Year who left to teach in another state. Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Dismantling Patriarchy on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Democracy Now! Broadcasts live from the UN Climate Summit every weekday from 8 to 9 a.m. through December 11th, right here on KKFI.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from just outside Paris, France, in Le Bourget at COP21, the UN Climate Summit. We're ending today's show looking at extreme carbon inequality. A new report by Oxfam has found the richest 10% of the world's population produce half of the Earth's climate-harming fossil fuel emissions. The poorest half, about 3.5 billion people, are responsible for only around 10% of total greenhouse gas emissions. Oxfam, the report, is titled Extreme Carbon Inequality, Why the Paris Climate Deal Must Put the Poorest, Lowest Emitting, and Most Vulnerable People First. To talk more, we're joined by the author of the report, Tim Gore, head of policy for Oxfam International on food, land rights, and climate change. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Tim.
Hey, Amy.
These figures are stunning. The world's richest 10% produce half of carbon emissions, while the poorest 3.5 billion account for just a tenth.
That's right. I mean, it's absolutely obscene. And what we're saying is that we absolutely have to tackle climate change and inequality together. We'll either solve both these problems or neither. I'll give you another stat. The richest 1% probably emit something like 175 times more than the poorest 10%. So, you know, this can't continue. We must tackle these two problems in tandem.
Mm-hmm. So what most surprised you in this report?
Well, one of the things that I think is surprising people, as well as these startling global numbers that we've just talked about, is the comparisons between countries. There's a lot of talk here in at the COP about the responsibilities of middle-income countries, India, China, Brazil, South Africa, etc. And one of the things that I think is striking to people is that when you compare the lifestyle emissions of even some of the richest citizens in those countries, they're still far, far lower than their counterparts in rich developed countries in the US and the European Union. So that's one of the things that I think is raising eyebrows, and it does shed a new light on the talks here. You know, when we think about these new emerging economies, yes, large emissions on a national scale, but even their richest, nothing like as high lifestyle emissions as citizens in Europe or the US.
How does this address, for example, the population control folks? You say, if you just limit population, this will take care of all these problems.
Oh, look, it's not. I mean, population growth is actually in the poorest countries where emissions are incredibly low. So, you know, that's not the problem here. The problem is, unfortunately, it's the richest. The richest people on the planet are responsible for the majority of the emissions. So we do have to do something about their emissions. But ultimately, we're not saying this is, you know, solely the responsibility of people in that richest 10%. You don't have to be that rich to get into the top 10% in terms of salaries in the US or Europe. But the real problem here, the real bloc is either vested interest in the fossil fuel industry, sort of the carbon barons. That's a tiny elite, and they're the ones that are really holding back progress.
So, Tim Gore, your report states that between the Copenhagen and Paris climate summits, that's between 2009 and 2015, the number of billionaires on the Forbes list with interest in fossil fuel activities has risen from 54 in 2010 to 88 in 2015, while the size of their combined personal fortunes have expanded by around 50%, from over $200 billion to more than $300 billion.
That's right. Now, you know, that's the real, you know, that should be the target of our campaigns, frankly. You know, these are the real problem. Yes, we need, you know, richer people to reduce their emissions. They need to do whatever they can in their lifestyles to do that. We need to support the poorest people to have access to renewable energy and adapt to climate change. But the real blockers here, you know, the real problems in this process are the fossil fuel interests. And that's who we need to go over. They're still making millions, billions even, from their investments in fossil fuels. And that's why it's great to have Bill McKibben and others that are fighting to get money taken out of those interests. And that's, you know, that should really be the target of our efforts.
So as the whole global education ramps up on the dangers of fossil fuels to everyone, just to repeat this, the number of billionaires on the Forbes list has gone from 54 with fossil fuel activities, yeah, interest in fossil fuel activities, to 88.
That's right.
Increasing exponentially.
Yeah, I mean, they're continuing almost oblivious to what the rest of the world is doing or experiencing. You know, we've had an increase in extreme weather events, new scientific studies, you know, more people, regular people taking action on the streets like we've seen in, around the world in the last few days. So despite the kind of growing public opinion and even political leaders speaking out, these guys are just unconcerned. They just continue to rake in the profits. And, you know, we've got to expose them as the real interest behind climate inaction in this process.
Talk about some of the solutions to dealing with extreme carbon inequality, as you call
sure.
it.
Well, first of all, we need a Paris Agreement that does deliver for that poorest half of the global population. So poorest people, least responsible for the problem, and actually also the most vulnerable to climate change. So they're living in countries that are highly impacted by droughts, by floods, by extreme weather events. So we've got to get a first step is to get a Paris deal that delivers for them. What does that look like? It means more adaptation finance on the table from the richest countries. At the moment, there's only something like between $3 and $5 billion dollars per year flowing to all developing countries. Now that amounts to something like $3 a day for every small-scale farmer on the planet. It's, you know, like a cup of coffee per year. So that's a total disgrace, frankly. So we need to get a big increase in adaptation finance flowing to the poorest. But then we also need to make sure that we're dealing with the impacts of climate change to which it's not possible to adapt. So islands that are being submerged by rising sea levels, crops that are being destroyed where it's not possible to replant. We need to make sure that there's something in this agreement to address that. And one of the big issues at the moment, we've got to make sure this is an agreement that respects human rights and gender equality, because, you know, that's under threat. We've got the European Union sitting on the fence of that. We've got the US not doing enough to defend those principles in this agreement. So these are some of the things that we must have. And of course, the agreement needs to drive down emissions much quicker than is on the table at the moment, because that, in the end, is what's going to determine whether those poorest people are going to have a chance to survive in this planet.
Let's talk about the unequal impact of climate change across the world. This is African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesina.
Africa, the least emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, now suffers the most from climate change. Others pollute, Africa pays, and pays dearly. Lake Chad is almost gone, and the sand dunes are encroaching the Sahel. We must not abandon Africa. Africa has been shortchanged by climate change. Africa must not be shortchanged by climate finance.
That was the president of the African Development Bank, President Akinwumi Adesina. Tim Gore, your response.
Well, I mean, he's absolutely right. I mean, those are powerful words, but they're the same words that we're hearing from small-scale farmers across the African continent and in many other regions of the world, actually. These are farmers whose livelihoods, of course, depend on the seasons. They depend on when the rains come. If they don't come, or they come at a different time, or they fall too late, or it's too strong when it does come, then that affects, you know, whether or not, frankly, they can grow enough food to sell to the market to feed their families for the year. So, you know, these are the people that must be in the minds of the negotiators that are here in Paris. You know, we can't imagine this is just a deal between the big powers like the US and China. We've got to make sure this is an agreement for the poorest people wherever they live.
You also deal with food. food and disease. Disease is another whole issue caused by climate change. As we wrap up, talk about the scarcity that people will suffer from.
Well, right now, we're actually witnessing around the world an unfolding food crisis. It's linked to the El Nino phenomenon, which is being supercharged by climate change. So from southern Africa to areas of East Asia and Central America, we're seeing droughts, we're seeing crops failing, and there are literally millions of people, countries like Ethiopia, that are at very serious risk of a major food crisis right now. That is the backdrop to these talks. It's not making headlines around the world. It's a slow onset event. It's not like a one-off big crisis, but you know, we're experiencing that. We're responding to that as Oxfam. That is what climate change looks like. You know, it means people going hungry, and that's why these talks matter so much. There are lives on the line.
Well, I want to thank you, Tim Gore, for being with us. Tim Gore is the author of Oxfam's new report called Extreme Carbon Inequality: Why the Paris Climate Deal Must Put the Poorest, Lowest Emitting, and Most Vulnerable People First. He's the head of policy for Oxfam International on food, land rights, and climate change. As we turn right now to Kathy Jetnell-Kajaner, poet and climate activist from the Marshall Islands. Just before the show, she shared a poem. She was standing in front of a fake Eiffel Tower that's been erected here that is built from the chairs, the small wooden chairs of the time that the Eiffel Tower was built. She recited this poem at the protest calling for fossil fuel divestment.
I am definitely a supporter of the divestment movement. I teach at the College of the Marshall Islands, the first college in the Micronesia to divest. So even though we're a small college, even though we don't even have as much funds as some of these bigger institutions, we took the step to divest. And the reason was because it depends on our survival. We will do everything we can to save our islands. And so, yeah. So I'll be sharing a poem about the beauty of our islands and what we want the world to know, which is that we shouldn't have to leave and that we shouldn't have to move from our islands because of the flooding. So this is a poem I wrote, and it's called Tell Them. I prepared the package for my friends in the States. First, the dangling earrings, woven into half moons, black pearls glinting like an eye in a storm of tight spirals. Second, the baskets, dirty, also woven, brown cowrie shell shiny, intricate mandalas shaped by calloused fingers. Inside the basket, I write a message. Wear these earrings to parties, to classes and meetings, to the corner store, the grocery store, and while riding the bus. Store jewelry, incense, copper coins, and curling letters like this one in this basket. And when others ask you where you got this, you tell them they're from the Marshall Islands. Show them where it is on a map. Tell them we are a proud people toasted dark brown as the carved ribs of a tree stump. Tell them we are descendants of the finest navigators in the world. Tell them our islands were dropped from a basket carried by a giant. Tell them we are the hollow hulls of canoes as fast as the wind slicing through the Pacific Sea. We are wood shavings and drying pandan and sleeves and sickly burritos and gammons. Tell them we are sweet harmonies of mothers, aunties, sisters, songs late into night. Tell them we are whispered prayers. Tell them we are little girls with braids, cartwheeling beneath the rain. We are shards of broken beer bottles burrowed beneath fine white sand. We are children flinging like rubber bands across the road, clogged with chugging cars. Tell them we only have one road. And after all this, you tell them about the water, how we have seen it rising, flooding across our cemeteries, gushing over our seawalls, and crashing against our homes. Tell them what it's like to see the entire ocean level with the land. Tell them we are afraid. Tell them we don't know of the politics or the science, but we see what's in our own backyard. Tell them some of us are old fishermen who believe that God made us a promise. Tell them some of us are a little bit more skeptical. But most importantly, you tell them that we don't want to leave. We never wanted to leave. And that we are nothing without our island. Thank you. This is why I support the divestment campaign, to support our island so that we don't have to leave from our island, so that we can do whatever we can to save our island. Thank you.
That was Kathy Jetnell-Kajaner, a poet and climate activist from the Marshall Islands, reciting her poem in front of an Eiffel Tower reproduction made from the bistro chairs
of the time that the Eiffel Tower was built. And that does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by an amazing team. Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez. Special thanks to John Hamilton, Renee Feltz, Dennis Moynihan, Ariel Boone, Chuck Skurich, Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, Anna Osbeck, and David Prude. You can go to our website at democracynow.org, see all of our coverage here from the COP21, the UN Climate Summit. You can read the transcripts. You can see the articles that we link to. You can get our video and audio podcast at democracynow.org. We also have a job opening. It's development director, leading our fundraising efforts. Just go to our website to check out the details and send in your resume. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Amy Goodman, live from the COP21 in Paris, France. Thanks so much for joining us.